Brilliant. So, the accused one trains oneself, liberating the mind, I breathe in, liberating the mind, I breathe out. So you can see the stage as being very like just sitting. So imagine we're just on a stage that's very like stage four of the traditional four-stage mindfulness of breathing. It's actually quite usual to follow that with a period of just sitting. Just as it's quite usual to follow a puja with a period of just sitting. We don't always do it, but it's often suggested. So you can see this stage of liberating the mind. You're following a stage of concentration, with a stage of completely letting go of all endeavor to do anything at all and just sitting. Having said that, with the ongoing underlying thread of attention to the breath, that's our anchor throughout the whole practice. So in just sitting, well, you can take that a number of ways, but the suggestion here is attending openly to whatever arises, whatever unfolds, whatever ceases, with a very broad, inclusive awareness. So that includes sensations, feelings, volitions, thoughts, allowing these to arise and pass just moment to moment as they do. So as I said, as I suggested in this meditation, we've got this very wide open breadth to awareness, but it's possible for that to be in focus in the sense of like a camera image. If you imagine like an SLR camera, you've got big wide open shot, you're just in the lens, there's a point where the whole image comes into focus. Okay, so it's a different idea of focus. It's not that there's any one particular point, it's like the whole image is coming into focus. And that can happen if we're kind of present, if we're really sort of alive here with the experience. So there's all of this stuff happening, and there isn't any particular centre of attention. So, in relation to hearing and sounds, we're hearing whatever sounds arise, but we're not listening to any particular sound. And in relation to sight, so the suggestion here is try this with your eyes open. So there's a complete openness to whatever experience impinges. And we're seeing whatever is in front of us, but we're not looking at anything in particular. So I hope that difference is sort of makes sense, the difference between seeing whatever's there or looking at something in particular. Hearing whatever's there rather than listening to anything particular. And so that's the canvas of this stage. And the particular approach is that we're trying to let go of, relax out of our habitual tendency to evaluate, to judge, and to identify with particular aspects of what's going on in the experience. And that's easier said than done. It does relate to what I was saying last week in relation to bringing clarity as a way of resolving hindrance. So we may well be aware of this going on. So we may well be aware of, okay, I've got evaluation, judgment going on, I'm identifying with some of my experience, kind of recognizing that's happening. And that's kind of the practice in a way, because awareness, well, to use Bhante's aphorism, awareness is revolutionary. One of the ways in which that's the case is that awareness kind of brings in the sense of choice rather than compulsion. So there's something happening, there's this evaluation, judgment, identification happening. Without awareness, it's liable to be just kind of habitual and compulsive, but with awareness, it's much less so. And so the opportunity to relax out of comes with awareness, to let go. So I wanted to just compare and contrast that with the theme I've been sort of reiterating at times through the weeks and the whole course is one of establishing and then relaxing into. So we start with posture, we establish a posture, and then we relax into the posture, into the quality of the posture. We establish an awareness of the body in stage three of the practice, and then we kind of relax into that, calming the body in stage four. We establish a awareness of the mind, a state of mind in stage seven, and then we relax into that, relaxing mind, stage eight. So that's very much a theme running through the practice, establishing the practice and relaxing into the practice. There's a sort of parallel, which is a sort of becoming aware of and then relaxing out of. Okay, so I don't want to confuse this with a relaxing out of posture, which is, you know, flopping. This is more in relation to, well, either hindrances or evaluations, judgments, identification. I'll focus in particularly on the aspect of identifying. So there's probably some particular part of that experience which I'm identifying with as possibly as this is me, possibly as this is mine, but also it may be driving an evaluation. So if I'm thinking in terms of I like this or I don't like that, you know, this is pleasant, unpleasant, tends to slide into I like this, I don't like that. So that's evaluation coming in, and there's a sort of it's rooted in a sense of identity, sense of me, and so I like this. So pleasant, unpleasant slips into like, dislike, slips into want, don't want, being for this, against that. These are sort of evaluations that are coming in. And we can just bring awareness to that, and then when we're kind of holding something as an experience that part of our mind's engaged in awareness, which is a broader aspect of mind, the possibility of kind of letting go opens up. So that's the sort of relaxing out of, in a sense of letting go. And letting go is rather different from getting rid of. Okay, so it's easy to kind of mix the two up initially. You think, perhaps because we think in terms of gravity, it's my visual aid. So here am I holding on to something, and I'm thinking in terms of letting go as dropping. You know, it's natural to think that way. It's like when I let go, surely it'll fall away. But it doesn't necessarily work that way, actually. And so think of it more in terms of I'm holding on like this, and then I let go. And in a sense, there's nothing, no dramatic consequence. You know, it hasn't fallen away; it's still there. But it's perhaps more helpful to think of letting go in terms of allowing it to be there for as long as it needs to be there. Because otherwise, we're more in the territory of trying to get rid of, you know, trying to. Yeah, if we want it to go away, then we haven't really let go. So that's perhaps if you sort of bring back in this metaphor of the radar, you know, sort of tuning in the radar. If you remember, we were tuning in the radar to Priti and Sukha earlier on in the course. So here we're sort of tuning in the radar to noticing where we're identifying, where we're evaluating, where we're judging, where we've got kind of views in play as to what's going on and who's in charge. And then there's a sort of bringing awareness to that, and then there's the opportunity to sort of relax out of that or let go. So this is the territory of the veil of views, the Nyaya Varana. So it's the teaching of the two veils. There's the veil of kleshas, which are more sort of emotion-driven affects. So traditionally greed, hatred and delusion. More subtly likes and dislikes, wants and not wants. And then there's the veil of views, the Nyaya Verinal. So that's seeing things in a particular way, in a fixed sort of way. And the root one, perhaps, is seeing things in terms of me. Okay. So here's self-referencing going on. I'll just drop in a couple of quotes from the Buddhist tradition to describe sort of how it might be if you can let that veil go, if you can let the veil of views drop away. Then experience just kind of reveals itself to us as it is. We don't need to interpret it, it's just kind of presenting itself. And so there's this quote from the Gradual Sayings that I dropped in last week. Mind, bhikkhus, is luminous, but it's obscured by obstructing defilements. And that's obstructing defilements, this is a veil of cloches. And then the next one goes on to say, mind, bhikkhus, is luminous, and it's unobscured by obstructing defilements. This basic idea that veils are just something that obscure an underlying luminous quality of awareness that's kind of there all the time. And when we get there, then, to quote from the Yadana, the Bahya Sutta, in the seen there's only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the cognized only the cognized. And when, O Bahya, in the seen there's only the seen, there will be no thereby. And when there's no thereby, there will be no therein. So that's the Buddha in the Bahya Sutta. And the other one that I wanted to drop in was from the Chan tradition. This is from Soen, the second or third patriarch, I think. And he wrote a very short work called The Sins in Me, which has quite a famous opening. It says, "The great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. The great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised." So you can see a sort of root in there, actually, because love and hate are quite strong words, and they suggest the hindrance of sense desire and ill will. But they also kind of fade into something a lot more subtle, which is like just preferences. You know, I like this, I don't like that. And when they're completely absent, there's this kind of no preference, which is very equanimous. And the teaching is that when they're completely absent, then everything is just clear and undisguised. It just presents itself, manifests itself to us as it is. So what's tending to happen is a sort of layer, a veil on top of that, of self-reference, a process of interpretation and discrimination. It's just kind of something that's going on. But the first step is to just notice that this is a process, that is something that's going on. And then when we notice that, when we bring awareness to that, we recognise also that actually it's not all of what's going on. It's just part of my mind is engaged in this process of interpreting, identifying, liking, disliking. And then, again, with awareness, the possibility of letting go comes in. But it's not something we can just stop. In just the same way that we can't just decide, right, I'm going to be in second dhyana now. You can't just do it. But you can kind of, you know, work creatively towards it in that direction. Yeah. And then as we do so, you know, in its own way, in its own time, it might just drop away. So don't think you have to be enlightened for the veils to drop away, just as you don't have to be enlightened to get into dhyana. You know, the reason you don't have to be is it's quite possible for greed, hatred and delusion to just be in abeyance for a while. So sense, desire and ill will can just be taking a break and there you are in dhyana. It doesn't mean that the propensity for greed and ill will and hatred has completely been eradicated. It just means that at the moment they're not manifesting. So similarly, it's not tantamount to gaining enlightenment for the sort of veil of self-reference to fall away. It's quite possible for it to just fall away for a while, and then there you are, seeing things as they are. Yeah. So that's it in a nutshell. I've ended on the notes, which I'll hand out at the end. A couple of comments on the pros and cons of meditating with your eyes open or meditating with your eyes closed. So I'll just drop those in at the moment. So the suggestion here, for this stage in particular, was try it with your eyes open, particularly because in this stage we're looking for a completely open awareness that's open to all experience. So openness is kind of the key. And shutting off, closing your eyes is shutting off from a whole sense of it. So we're suggesting try opening your eyes. So opening your eyes can be good for countering mental preoccupation, fantasy, drowsiness. It can counter the downside of probably we all typically meditate with our eyes closed, so in a way that's the habit. So eyes closed can be good for a freedom from visual disturbance, can give you a sort of interiority and awareness of feelings and emotions. It can open that sphere up to you. But it can lead to this sort of mental preoccupation, which is just another feature of this sort of interiority, or even fantasy, or sort of dropping into sloth, drowsiness, torpor. So if that's happening in particular, opening your eyes can be quite effective as a way of just cutting through mental preoccupation. So if you find you're in prapancha, you're just very interior, very preoccupied in a inner world sort of way, opening your eyes can just cut straight through that. There's a world out there. But it can lead to distraction. If your concentration is not fully established, it can lead to distraction. And obviously it depends how much movement and activity there is going on. So here we're in quite a fortunate situation that we're in the shrine room. It's actually enclosed, it's very quiet, it's very still, so eyes open, there's not going to be a lot of distraction. So that's the suggestion, try it with your eyes open. And again, it sort of ups the stakes. So in stage 11 and in stage 12, we're sort of raising the bar. So in stage 11, we're sort of raising the bar for a level of concentration by looking for a very fine, very precise, clear, specific focus. And then that immediately introduces the need to keep that balance, to keep that from becoming tight and hard. So here in stage 12, we're sort of raising the bar for this kind of just wide open, broad awareness that is nonetheless undistracted. So that's characteristic of just sitting, which I compared it to at the beginning of this bit of the talk. So just sitting as a practice is quite a steep practice because you're looking for a quality of presence, awareness, which doesn't have any supports at all. You know, all the supports for just sitting kind of happened before. So particularly in these contexts where we're looking at just sitting following the four stages of the usual four-stage mindfulness breathing, or just sitting following the puja, it's like there's a momentum built up, and then the just sitting is a space in which to allow that to roll. So in a sense, it's raising the bar. It's raising the bar in the sense that we're looking for a quality of presence, a quality of awareness that at the moment, in the moment, doesn't have any support at all. There's no particular focus. And perhaps Sage Trial is also raising the bar in that it's particularly directing the mind to something quite subtle that might be initially quite unfamiliar, which is this process of identification, self-reference, evaluation that tends to be quite habitual. And what's habitual tends to be quite difficult to bring into awareness. So that's the invitation. And I'm aware that it's a bit of a challenge because there isn't a very clear, specific, you know, what to do teaching involved. You know. But I'm wondering if there's enough there by way of a invitation, an evocation of the intention in stage 12, in this stage 2. To work with, which is another way of saying, any questions?
you've still got the breath as an anchor, though.
Yeah. There's still the breath as an anchor. Yeah. Minimally, I'd say. Minimally. Yeah.
Are you going to guide us?
Yeah. True. So what I propose to do for this last meditation is we'll do start with stage 3 and then stage 11 again, but I'll just drop in the phrases. So, you know, aware of the whole body, breathe in, so getting this really broad, grounded awareness. And then stage 11, concentrating the mind, I breathe in, so bringing in this very particular fine focus, balancing that against the broad awareness. And then when we get to stage 12, I'll lead it a bit more. Yeah, liberating the mind. Yeah, I'll drop in some more suggestions. Yeah. Okay, should we try?